Good afternoon.
I'm going to pose a question this afternoon, which, for those of you who know me, may be somewhat surprising. The question is, are the precepts obsolete? Now, the reason I ask that question, or I pose that question, is that it's a question that's being posed. Not so much here, because we're pretty big on precepts, but in the Buddhist, Western Buddhist world in general, the question is arising as to whether perhaps there are other aspects of training which are more effective than the precepts in leading one to the truth, and that perhaps the precepts actually get in the way. Now, as one of my positions here for a number of years has been sort of a precepts and Vinaya specialist, which, by the way, doesn't mean that I am a paragon of virtue. It means I've spent a bit of time studying this stuff, so I'm a resource person on it. From that position, the question seemed at first glance a bit strange to me. On the other hand, it never hurts to question one's most fundamental assumptions and have a good hard look. So that's what I'd like to try to do this afternoon, is have a good hard look at the question of whether or not the precepts really are necessary and wise, or are they obsolete? Now, to explain the position of why they might be obsolete, I want to read you something which explains that position far better than I. This is from an article entitled, No Precepts, Please, from the fall 1994 issue of Turning Wheel, which is the Buddhist Peace Fellowship newsletter. It is a very thoughtful article which describes the author's reactions and her later analysis or understanding of her reactions to a retreat that she attended with the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, at which the precepts were the sort of culminating event of the taking of the precepts was the culminating event of this retreat, much as our Jukai would be. And she found herself unable to do that. And here, listen to her reasons, because there's some very interesting things in here that I'd like to address. I did not stay to take the precepts. The morning mists were just rising across the Shenandoah Valley as I eased my car onto the interstate. While the miles rolled away behind me, I examined my own refusal to accept this concluding step. I have been living with precepts all my life. As Ram Dass so exquisitely puts it, I was a, quote, good child. The pride of my parents in school, an academic leader in college, I was determined to be an exemplary wife and mother, Bren, 1950 style, and at the same time to use the education I'd received. Thanks to gifts of health and energy, I was able to do so, although it cost many years of 14-hour workdays. Along the way, I took part in vigils, marched in peace protests, nursed a depressed alcoholic husband, saw my daughters through college. Now, in my 60s, I find myself sharing home and retirement years with an aged mother who needs constant care. Yes, I think I've been a good child. And I'm not sorry if it is so. In fact, the years have brought me both love and joy, more joy than most of us are ever granted. Although there are certainly things I wish I'd done differently, they do not loom large in the perspective of time. But please, no more precepts. Christianity and other religions have plenty, and I seriously doubt that after 3,000 years the world will benefit by any more. However careful we may be, framing standards of conduct implies drawing distinctions and passing judgments on ourselves and others. Does this not contradict the essence of mindfulness? Is not acting with compassion that arises from the moment, from the sense of kinship, a sufficient guide to being, quote, engaged, unquote? For me, the great gift of insight meditation has been liberation from the very stuff of precepts. It has replaced the disciplined drive to honor prohibitions and achieve goals with the recognition that all prohibitions are futile and all goals ephemeral. A walking meditator leaves no footprints in the sands of time. The point of spiritual practice for me is learning to free myself. Vowing to pursue right conduct lies squarely across the path I seek to follow. Along that path, there is no one vowing, no one committed to this or that, no reason to fear, no virtue to attain. There is recognition that a lifetime of personal memories has no more substance than thought itself. Attention is upon the present and on the immediate experience of partaking in an infinitely complex and wonderful world. The world is as it is. The very fact of life's existence in time and in material form means suffering, but limitless suffering also implies the presence of limitless compassion for the weed, the spider, the sparrow, the human spirit. If we can truly open ourselves to that reality, precepts are unnecessary. And if we cannot, precepts will only be a few more rules to follow. Now, I think the crux, although there are several things in here I'd like to address, I think the crux is that last sentence. If we can truly open ourselves to that reality, precepts are unnecessary. And if we cannot, precepts will only be a few more rules to follow. Well, I did a bunch of thinking on that. You know, I think I agree with her. But quite the way she intended it. Look at the first half of the sentence. If we can truly open ourselves to the reality, precepts are unnecessary. Okay, fair enough. What does it mean to truly open oneself to that reality? To be fully, okay, truly open, to be fully at one with the reality of basically everything. If you're fully at one with the reality of everything, you are not excluding anything. You are that reality. If you are at one with it, you are that reality, i.e., you are enlightened. Now, what is one of the characteristics of an enlightened being? They don't make karma. Our master used to say, the enlightened being leaves no wake. And I could quote you plenty of scriptural references that suggest that arahants and bodhisattvas and buddhas and the like don't produce karma, particularly not negative karma. Okay, what's that mean? How do you produce negative karma? Well, you produce negative karma through doing certain things with the volitional act. Okay? There has to be a volition component and an action component to produce negative karma. And the things that are the actions have to do harm in some way or another. I mean, if they did good, you'd be producing positive karma. Okay? Well, what are volitional actions that produce harm? Well, if you start trying to enumerate them, you can do that in your own mind, or you can look it up somewhere, you start getting lists like killing, stealing, saying that which is not true, etc., etc. Your list is going to start looking a lot like the precepts. In other words, if, as this author says, you are truly open to that reality, then indeed the precepts are unnecessary. They're unnecessary because there's no need to keep precepts if you are one with the precepts. You are the precepts. There's nothing to keep. You simply act at one with the precepts at all moments, because there is nothing else to do in the state of enlightenment. Put it another way, a quote from the Brahmajala Sutra, from Reverend Hubert's translation in the Scripture of Brahma's Net. It's another way of looking at the identity of the precepts and enlightenment and our own fundamental nature. So that when we are at one with that fundamental nature, we are at one with, we are the precepts. For the sake of all beings on this earth, however worldly or ignorant they may be, he, this is Vairochana Buddha, gave voice to the radiance of the precepts embedded within the foundations of training of Vairochana Buddha, those precepts which are continually recited within a heart that has given rise to the intent to realize Buddhahood. These precepts of the light that is precious as diamond are fundamental to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They are the seeds of Buddha nature. All sentient beings have Buddha nature. Consequently, all their intentions, perceptions, desires, and attitudes, as well as all the passions and feelings connected with them, are encompassed within the precepts of Buddha nature. Since, of necessity, there is always causality, so there is always, of necessity, an ever-abiding embodiment of truth. This is why the 10 liberating precepts appeared in the world. These are the precepts of the Dharma that all sentient beings receive, that all may keep to them. I will reiterate these 10 inexhaustible precepts of the treasure house for the sake of the multitude here assembled. Since these precepts are intended for all sentient beings, whose self-nature is, from the first, immaculate. Okay, so the first half of this proposition seems all right to me. If you really are completely at one with reality, you don't need to keep the precepts because you are the living embodiment of the precepts. What about the second half? And if we cannot, precepts will only be a few more rules to follow. Well, first let's take that to its extreme. Let's take cannot literally. Or perhaps it could be phrased will not. If one absolutely is closed to that reality, not a chink open, then indeed precepts will simply be another set of rules, probably to be ignored. And if not ignored, then implemented with the same deluded mind that is keeping one closed to reality, and therefore implemented with, for example, self-righteousness, or self-criticism, or lack of compassion, or whatever it may be that is keeping one's mind closed. In other words, one is apt to do more harm with them than good, because if one's mind is absolutely and firmly closed to the whole business of reality, they're going to be treated as just another thing. Okay, so the second half, if you take it to its extreme, the second half of the proposition also works. But what about the middle? There's no middle. What about those of us who are open to reality imperfectly? Well, it sure includes me.
Maybe not River Master owns you, but hell, at least me.
Includes me. What about those of us who are mindful some of the time, but not always? And we know it. What about those of us who are compassionate? Maybe even most of the time. But every once in a while, something gets in the way. What about us who need a little bit of guidance on the way when we get, therefore, into murky ethical issues where it isn't clear to us, where our mindfulness, our compassion, whatever, isn't sufficient to show us what to do reliably and 100%. Now, for those of us in the middle, which, as someone suggested, is probably a fair swatch of us, there being very few saints and very few true rats in the world, obviously, the precepts for those of us in the middle are a possible source of guidance. Now, I would suspect that our author friend would say, yes, they're a possible source, but there are others that are better. All right. Maybe there are. Let's have a look. Our author might also say, yes, they're a possible source, but they may be doing more harm than good. All right, let's have a look at that too. Now, what about the first side of that? What might be better? What might be a substitute for the precepts that somehow is preferable? Well, several are actually implicitly suggested in this article. One is the combination of mindfulness and compassion. Okay. If one is mindful and at the same, one sees what's going on, one is paying attention to what is going on, one is paying attention, and there is compassion, it should work, shouldn't it? It seems like it would work. So that might be a substitute. Trouble is, here again, for those of us in the middle, there are those times when we aren't mindful. There are the times when something gets in the way of compassion. And then there's a third problem, and that is that you can be completely mindful of something and completely at one with your compassion, but if you don't have an adequate degree of wisdom and understanding to know what it is you're being mindful of, there's a problem, i.e., if you aren't, you can be aware and you can be compassionate, but if you've got a little screw turned a little bit the wrong way and your view of reality is just slightly off center, you're going to act on that instead of what's really there, and you may inadvertently do damage. In other words, in this imperfect world, blind spots occur. And the combination of compassion and mindfulness may not always be enough to point out those blind spots. Now, I think I have found an example of that in another article I read recently, and this is the article that actually got me to doing this lecture. I remembered this 1994 article, but this is the one that actually tweaked me into doing this. This is an article in the most recent, or the winter 1996 issue of Tricycle, which is a popular Buddhist magazine. It's in the section called On Practice. It's called Liberating Self-Righteousness. Let me start reading it. Some aspiring Buddhists appear to be hindered in their progress by a form of secular Calvinism that has persisted as a deeply buried fossil from childhood. This fossil manifests itself as self-righteousness. Self-righteousness is another word for spiritual arrogance. This arrogance limits our aspiration to take a larger, compassionate view of the world. It also fuels the creation of a condemning mind, a mind that is more closed than open. The following spiritual practice may be used to work with self-righteousness. If you do not carry out this practice, notice carefully the thoughts, emotions, and feelings that arise as you consider and reject. How do these emotions act as an obstacle to your own liberation? How do they arise as an obstacle to compassion and helping others? The practice. Rent a hotel room. Then look in the yellow pages for an escort service. Notice guilt and fear arising. Mm-hmm. Call an escort service and request another human being. Be explicit about your desire and needs. Notice if guilt and fear arise. Gently encourage yourself to be more explicit. Hair color, shape, clothing, age, gender. Notice the fear of precision. Notice fear of what others will say. If guilt or shame arise, feel them and remain mindful. When the escort arrives, invite him or her in, etc., etc. Now, this is a family program. I'm not going to tell you all the rest of the details of this practice, but I think you can see where it's leading. This is a description in very compassionate, very mindful terms of making a spiritual practice of procuring and using a prostitute. Okay, well, I looked this through, I sort of my jaw dropped, and I read this three or four times. I showed it to some of the other ones. I said, is this a satire? Is this a satire? There's no indication that it is. It's done very, very delicately. And knowing a little bit about Tricycle, I doubt it is a satire. They tend to like sort of things that get people stirred up a bit. All right. As I read through this, maybe I'm fooling myself, but I honestly didn't notice all that much condemnation. And what else am I supposed to see? I'm supposed to feel condemnation and rejection. Okay, I didn't really seem to feel much of that, but what I did feel was, there's something wrong with this picture. What is wrong with this picture? There's something wrong here. I can't put my finger on it, but I know there's something wrong here. And what I think is wrong here is that mindfulness, there certainly is. If you read the rest of it, you'd see compassion, there seems to be. But it's in the context of exploiting another human being. That's the blind spot. That's the blind spot. Using another human being's body and emotions as using it for your practice. Practicing on another human being. And I suspect that produces harm. Now, I didn't choose to put this practice into effect, so I don't know how I would have felt afterwards. But if I remember my Sociology 101 readings correctly, most people don't feel too good after they visited a prostitute. And most prostitutes, if I remember my readings correctly, don't feel too good about their way of livelihood. And presumably it has something to do with this business of exploitation. Presumably exploitation hurts in some way. So, if this isn't a satire, maybe this is an example of where compassion and mindfulness aren't enough. There's a blind spot. Now, the precepts would have pointed that out pretty clearly. The precepts would have said, something going on here. Watch it. But perhaps something else could have done better. Let's take a look at another possibility. How about the wisdom and the freedom that come with meditation and non-attachment? How about those as substitutes for the precepts? Let's see. She talks about that a little bit, at least implicitly, I think. Yeah. Vowing to pursue right conduct lies squarely across the path I seek to follow. Along that path there is no one vowing, no one committed to this or that, no reason to fear, no virtue to attain. Okay? Well, that ought to work too. It's like the other one ought to. I mean, look at that second sentence. Along that path, there is no one... Suppose we are in this position. Suppose we are in the position in the state in which there is no one vowing, no one committed to this or that, no reason to fear, and no virtue to attain. That sounds an awful lot like shunyata, the wisdom of the void, the Dharmakaya. There is no one there. There is no commitment. There is no virtue. There is no fear. There is no self. There is no other. There is just the shining void, the shining truth, the shining purity. That ought to be enough. And according to the Sharangama, if that's where you are, it is enough. They achieve samadhi, they will realize the profound, eternal, and still state, which is free from the duality of existence and non-existence, and is also beyond this very freedom from duality. Okay, that's the state we're talking about. In such a state, where even non-killing, non-stealing, non-carnality cannot be found, how can there be such evils as killing, stealing, or carnality? Okay. It ought to work. If one is in that state, it will work. But how do you know you're in that state? Well, if you think about it, you know you're not. So you can't think about it. Let me describe to you another state which you can get into. It looks a lot like the one we just talked about, but it isn't quite. Follow this chain of logic, if you will. The basic teaching of the Lotus Sutra is that all existences and all laws are void and fundamentally non-existent. This includes the law of karma. Thus, enlightened action, being inherently void and empty, produces no karmic consequence. We are also taught that all action done with the Buddha-seeking mind is enlightened action, and our very mind is the Buddha-seeking mind, when we do not cloud it with deliberate or discriminative thought. Therefore, if we are to be wholehearted and truly courageous in our practice, caring only for the truth, regardless of social convention and the opinions of others, we must act, and act without hesitation or deliberation, upon whatever natural thought comes to our mind. Only in this way will we truly know the freedom of Zen. And such actions, if truly done without discrimination or judgment, will have no karmic consequence, since they are one with the void. Suppose, now, that the next thought that comes into your mind is, to take an example here, let's say the desire to have sex with a prostitute. You mustn't think about it. You mustn't weigh it against the precepts, because that would be deliberate thought. What you must do is do it. And there won't be karmic consequence, because when you are one with the truth, you are not affected by the karma of actions that come from non-deliberate natural thought. Oh, how many years is a fox's dies we going to get for that? If I die right now without explaining myself, I'll be a fox for 500 years. Very slippery business. The first part of that's okay. Yeah, all existences and laws are void. They are fundamentally non-existent. That applies to karma. Everything is non-existent. Enlightened action, because it is inherently void and empty, and because it is one with the precepts anyway, produces no karmic consequence, no problem. Okay, and now we start getting into, you can just take things a little bit off from the way they were meant, and you get plop into this state I've just described here. We're also taught that all action done with the Buddha-seeking mind is enlightened action, and our very mind is the Buddha-seeking mind, and we do not cloud it with deliberate or discriminative thought. Yeah, in one sense it is, and in one sense, not quite. In the fundamental sense, yes. However, how do you know what is deliberate and discriminative thought? How do you know what is natural thought? How do you distinguish between natural thought and impulse, the impulsivity of the self? How do you discern, if you're not thinking now, and that's all part's all right, if you're not thinking, how do you discern? Wisdom from selfishness in this imperfect world. I need help. Precepts are one way of doing that. The precepts are one way of doing that because if you compare your unfettered, free, spontaneous action with the precepts, and you find them in accord, you're probably all right. If you find them in opposition, something's wrong somewhere. And if you don't happen to have a live teacher right there, or a live community of practice, whether lay or monastic, right there to help knock you back on track, the precepts are about the only safeguard you've got from falling off into this trap that I just set for you. And it's a very insidious trap, and people do fall into it. And they identify spontaneous action within their own non-thinking impulsivity for enlightenment. And once you get into that trap, it's very hard to get out, because everything then gets interpreted within that system. And if someone else, once you're well and truly into it, someone else tries to point things out to you, basically you regard their concerns for your well-being and those that the people you interact with, as small-minded, narrow concerns that you have transcended. As one person who was in this state once put it, when confronted with the fact that their actions weren't making sense in terms of precepts or much of anything else, they simply said, Buddhas do what Buddhas do. How do you answer that? Worse yet, if you're in that state, how do you get out? So, yes, the wisdom and freedom that come from meditation and non-attachment do work, if they are 100%, as the Sharingama points out. And there is a grave danger of running straight off the rails into something very unpleasant without knowing it, necessarily, if you try to take that substitute route for the precepts. So, okay. Those are the two main types of substitute that I'm aware of that have been postulated. Neither of them look too good to me. One has holes in it, and the other is exceedingly risky. So maybe there aren't substitutes for the precepts. But Maybe there's another reason alluded to in this article that the precepts are obsolete anyway, and that is that they're doing more harm than good. Why would they be doing more harm than good? Going back to our article again. However careful we may be, framing standards of conduct implies drawing distinctions and passing judgments on ourselves and others. Does this not contradict the essence of mindfulness? I.e., are precepts and the taking of precepts inherently judgmental? Well, I think that depends on whether one is drawing distinctions or whether one is passing judgments. We draw distinctions, do we not, every time we say, propel around the world that ton and a half of metal we call a car. We draw distinctions lest we squash living beings at the stoplight. We draw distinctions when we make soup for our family, lest we poison them. We distinguish between edible and non-edible components for soup. We put in the edible ones. We leave the poisonous ones out. That is making a distinction. One can do those things mindfully, as one can any activity, and that doesn't seem, at least in my experience, to be a problem. It doesn't seem to be something which goes against mindfulness to make distinctions. One can make soup mindfully and still distinguish the edibles from the non-edibles. Okay? Why can't one, in the same way, distinguish, let's say, between something that one is about to say which is truthful versus another variant of it which is not quite truthful? I see no reason why that can't be done as mindfully as the making of soup or the propelling around of a car. On the other hand, any of those three things, the driving, the cooking, and the taking of precepts about, the implementation of precepts about truthfulness, can be done with a judgmental mind. One can, for instance, drive around cussing the other drivers for their stupidity. One can, for instance, in the making of soup, refuse to use any leftover ingredients because they're inferior. Those are judgments. One can, in the implementation of a precept on truthfulness, call oneself either a saint or a liar. Those are judgments. So it seems to me that the problem is not with the precepts, but with the attitude with which they are undertaken and implemented, which can be either judgmental, as anything else can be, or simply discerning, without judgment. In other words, I don't buy that first argument. I don't buy that the precepts are inherently judgmental. They are inherently discerning, but they need not be judgmental. Okay, what about another one of the problems with the precepts, so-called problems, that was referred to in this article? The yes, I have been a good child argument. Okay, do the precepts effectively infantilize us? Do they focus us on unrealities, things like goals, rules, and in so doing, do they keep us from true spirituality? Now, one way of looking at this, and it's a fairly extreme way off on the side of determinism, is, well, one can say there's a hidden agenda behind the precepts. And you can postulate a number of possible hidden agendas that could be there. I don't know if there are any Marxists left in the world. There must be a few. If you, for instance, if you were a Marxist, you could say, well, we all know that religion is the opiate of the masses, and precepts and rules and things like that that religions have are the way the ruling class keeps the people in line, keeps the working class in line, i.e., don't take over the factory, it's stealing. Okay? Mm-hmm. Could the precepts be used that way? Sure they could. Have they been used that way? I don't know. But I bet you they probably were at some time somewhere. I bet they've been misused in that way. The question is that inherently what's going on in the precepts? Same argument to, let's say, psychological determinism. I know there are still some Freudians in the world. Precepts and other moral codes as internalized voice of the parent, superego stuff, okay? This is how the parent transfers his or her values to the child. Nothing evil in that. It's just the way things work. Well, okay. Does that happen? Sure it happens. We believe in the precepts. We have kids. We tell our kids about the precepts. Some of them internalize that. There they go. They have a set of precepts. They're copying our value system. Okay, that's fine. That's the way it works. But is that all that's going on? Are the precepts simply a value system that gets passed on? Or is there something else going on? Similarly, you can take the sort of social anthropology position. Things like the precepts are a way that a culture has of passing on the social contract, things like we don't kill each other in this society, okay, to the next generation of the society. Do the precepts serve that function sometimes? Of course they do. But is that all that's going on? I don't think that's all that's going on. One major reason is that if those determinist arguments were all that was going on, I don't think the precepts would have survived against the onslaught of 2,500 years of meditation. The reason I say that is meditation is very radical stuff. Look at what you do when you meditate. You bring your mind back to just what is. No matter what voices you hear from the society or the internalized parent or the whatever, you bring your mind back to just what is. And gradually those voices get weaker. They don't yammer as much. And gradually you act more and more on what is and less on the voices of our own thoughts. And that gradually will undermine all those thought guidance systems, and hopefully there will be something else emerge. It's a very, very radical thing. It cuts through all manner of delusions and all manner of illusions and all manner of ideals and all sorts of other thoughts, of which conventional moral values is one set. So meditation being an exceedingly radical thing, if the precepts were simply a conventional set of morality, they wouldn't have survived all this meditation for all this time. I'm going to quote you a little piece from the Lankavatara Sutra, and I think is related to this. It refers to the stream entered, that is to say, those who have dropped off body and mind and entered the stream of the way of the Buddhas. Again, Mahamati, how is it that the stream entered do not hold themselves to the morality? By here, the morality, they're referring to the precepts, among other things. Do not. Okay? They do not, because they clearly see into the nature of suffering wherever they may be reborn. Now, what is meant by holding, i.e. holding themselves to the morality? What is meant by holding? Mahamati, the ignorant and simple-minded observe the rules of morality, piety, and penance because they desire thereby to attain worldly enjoyments and happiness, i.e. the carrot and the stick, the things we were just talking about, one form or another. They cherish the hope of being born, or whether in this world or in the next, in agreeable conditions. The stream entered do not hold to the rules of morality, for their thoughts are turning only towards the exalted state of self-realization. And, this is in all the same sentence now, and the reason why they devote themselves to the morality in detail is precisely because they wish to master such truths as are in conformity with non-discrimination and the undefiled. This, Mahamati, is the way in which the stream-entered ones do hold to the morality and piety. Okay? It's not, therefore, simply a case of conventional rules of some sort. There's something else behind them. There's something else going on, and that something else not only withstands the onslaught of the radical force of meditation, but flowers within it. So there's no hidden agenda, fundamentally, as I see it, in the precepts. Though agendas can be imposed on them. Anything can be misused. Or anything can be, that's in the case of the keeping people in line position, or anything can be used for less exalted reasons, as in the case of we simply transfer our values to our kids. Natural thing to do. That's the way it works. Society does that at large, no problem. But there's no, as I said, there's no hidden agenda because it couldn't have survived all this meditation. But there is an open agenda. This is from the Gradual Sayings, Volume 5. This is an ancient, one of the ancient Pali texts. It goes all the way back as far about as far as they go, a couple hundred years B.C., the Anguttara Nikaya. Thus have I heard. On a certain occasion, the Exalted One, that's the Buddha, was staying near Savatthi in the Jeta Grove in Anathapindika's park. Then the Venerable Ananda came to see the Exalted One, and on coming to him saluted the Exalted One and sat down on one side. So seated, the Venerable Ananda said this to him, "Pray, sir, what is the object? What is the profit of good conduct?" There's a footnote here indicating that good conduct is the translation that this author makes of sila, okay, which is what is referred to generally as preceptual things. Okay? We're talking about the precepts here. Why, Ananda, freedom from remorse is the object. Freedom from remorse is the profit of good conduct. I like Ananda. He and I have a lot in common on both sides, the positive and the negative. But sir, what is the object, what is the profit of freedom from remorse? Joy, Ananda, is the object. Joy is the profit of freedom from remorse. Pray, sir, what is the object, what is the profit of joy? Rapture, Ananda, is the object. Rapture is the profit of joy. But pray, sir, what is the object, what is the profit of rapture? Calm, Ananda. Calm is the object and the profit of rapture. But, sir, what is the object, what the profit of calm? Happiness, Ananda, is the object. Happiness, the profit. Pray, sir, what is the object, the profit of happiness? Concentration, which is his translation of samadhi, Ananda, is the object. Concentration, or samadhi, is the profit of happiness. But pray, sir, what is the object, what is the profit of samadhi? Knowing and seeing things as they really are, Ananda. This is the object and profit of samadhi. What is the object, sir, what the profit of knowing and seeing things as they really are? The fading of attachment, Ananda. The fading of attachment is the object of it. Pray, sir, what is the object and profit of the fading of attachment? Release, Ananda, is the object and profit of these. So you see, Ananda, good conduct has freedom from remorse as object and profit, and that has joy, and that rapture, and rapture has calm, and calm has happiness, happiness has samadhi, samadhi has seeing things as they really are, seeing things as they really are has the fading of attachment, and the fading of attachment has release. So you see, Ananda, good conduct leads gradually to the summit of all. That's the agenda. And it's not hidden. Enlightenment is the agenda of the precepts. Now, this suggests, starting with the precepts, in a progression. And that indeed is one way that it works. Quote you Dogen on this. Two of his quotes. This is volume 1 of the Nishiyama Stevens translation. Page 136, a chapter called Shukke. When we begin to seek the way and practice Zazen, the precepts must come first. If we have not separated ourselves from illusion or evil action and have failed to keep the precepts, how can we hope to become Buddhas and patriarchs, Buddhas and ancestors? Break forward. Same progression. But once you've read enough Dogen, you know he never leaves it there. He likes to make things end up where they start and start where they end up, because they do. This is from the Shishogi, the translation in Zen's Eternal Life. This will be familiar to all of you, but listen to it in this particular context. If you accept these precepts wholeheartedly, the highest enlightenment will be yours. And this is the undestroyable Buddhahood, which was understood, is understood, and will be understood in past, present, and future. Is it possible that any truly wise person would refuse the opportunity to attain to such heights? The Buddha has clearly pointed out to all living beings that whenever these precepts are truly accepted, Buddhahood is reached. Every person who accepts them becoming the true child of Buddha. Within these precepts dwell the Buddhas, enfolding all things within their unparalleled wisdom. There is no distinction between subject and object for any who dwell therein. All things, earth, trees, wooden posts, bricks, stones, become Buddhas once this refuge is taken. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment when the flames are fanned by the Buddha's influence. This is the merit of non-action and non-seeking, the awakening to true wisdom. In other words, he's saying, the taking of the precepts itself is enlightenment. It is the way. And both are true. There is a progression, and there is also what Dogen is pointing to on a deeper level, that there is, just as he says that Zazen is enlightenment, and as he says, all practice. There is no distinction between practice and enlightenment. Practice is enlightenment. Enlightenment is practice. So, the taking of the precepts in and of itself is enlightenment. It is an enlightened act, and an enlightened act being one with enlightenment, it is enlightenment. I think it helped to understand that if one looks at the precepts and their form a little more closely than we sometimes do. Because one of the things which our friendly author here has done is to equate the precepts with the commandments of Christianity and other religions. And in some, on one level, there are obvious similarities. There should be. I mean, the spiritual essence, whatever we may wish to call it, of humankind, has discerned over the centuries that it is not a good thing to go around slaughtering each other and taking that which is not given and lying to each other, etc. So it would be very strange if the major religions of the world didn't have some measure of agreement on these kinds of things. Yet there are also differences. One of the things about the Buddhist precepts that distinguishes it is that this is not a set of proscriptions laid down by some deity or any other sort of cosmic authority figure that someone may conceive a deity to be. I don't particularly think of deities in that way, but some people do. Obviously, this author does. To me, the distinction can be made between precepts or moral codes as proscriptions, lists of don'ts, versus descriptions, descriptions of the way of training, descriptions of that which leads, as we just saw in these quotes from the Pali, from one thing to the next, from one blessing, one good to the next, all the way up the chain. Viewed in that way, it becomes difficult to mistake the precepts for the rules of childhood, as this author did. And it becomes easier to accept them not as rules at all, but as a portable guide, as a portable friend, as a portable description of our true nature, of our Buddha nature. Reverend Master said something on this in Zen is Eternal Life. Here, oddly enough, it's in the chapter on koans, talking about the trainee who has gone a modest ways in this process. The trainee keeps the precepts because it is in his inclination to do so, and not because it is a moral code which is incumbent upon him to keep as the result of an outside deity. Here again, the connection of Zen training with the old Buddhist precepts is exemplified. I'll explain what she means about that. The moral codes of most religions are enforced by a deity from outside, but the Buddhist takes the moral discipline of Buddhism upon himself. Because an external deity is lacking, conviction of the truth of the precepts must be generated from within the trainee. This is the correct use of the conviction-stimulating reflection, an example, i.e. the koan technique. But lots of other aspects of training do that. When the teacher sees that the pupil has made the moral code his natural way of life, he knows that the latter has finally taken Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for refuge in the true meaning of the words. One has to live Buddhism, be Buddhism, to do this. The precepts must flow through one's veins as does one's very lifeblood. Just as we do not notice the coursing of our blood, but permit it to flow unhindered, so the Buddhist lives the code of the precepts unhindered by them, and unhindering them. The certainty of understanding that comes at various times, the kensho, as a result of meditation, deepens the spirituality and character of the person, and enables him or her to enter into the precepts ever more deeply. Once it is second nature to be constantly exemplifying the precepts, one is not conscious of doing so, and so is not conscious of being either bound or Buddha. Therefore, Buddha recognizes Buddha when the trainee beholds the master and the master beholds Buddha in the pupil, when both keep the precepts with no smell of holiness and no taint of evil. For Buddha then walks, sleeps, sits, eats, and works in both of them, without any knowledge of Buddha and no attachment thereto. This is spiritual autonomy. Remember, Master always saying this is a religion for spiritual adults. That's a good definition of spiritual adulthood. She referred to the tie of Zen to the old precepts. The ancient form of the precepts, the earliest form of which we have record, can be either in the Sanskrit or the Pali, this is a Pali version, is as follows. They will start off with a word that refers to the action that is of concern, killing, stealing, whatever it may be. Then follows the phrase, Varamani Sikapadam Samadhyami. And this is usually, this can be translated in lots of different ways. And many of the ways that have come down to us through the Chinese and the Japanese and translated into English are very abbreviated. So you look at the precepts as we have them, say, in the Kyoju Kaimon, and they are things like, do not kill, do not steal. Now, there is a value to that abbreviation. It brings things forward in a simple, direct, and powerful way. But, like everything else in the world, there's a cost. And the cost is, in order to abbreviate things, how do you abbreviate something and simplify something? You leave stuff out. That's the only way you can abbreviate. And one of the other costs is that in these abbreviated forms, to those who have not had a lot of experience in talking about the Buddhist precepts and thinking about them and doing them, it can look like a set of commandments. I mean, do not kill looks a heck of a lot like thou shalt not kill. It's not quite the same. There's no God saying, but it's pretty close, and it can easily be confused for it. So it sometimes helps, and this is what River Master was alluding to here, to go back to the original form and see what all that other stuff was that got abbreviated out in order to get these simple, powerful forms that we most commonly use. So this takes us to one of our Daisui's other favorite places, the Abhidhamma. Now, most monks, when you start talking about the Abhidhamma, their eyes roll back in their heads. The Abhidhamma is the third section of the Buddhist scriptures. The sections we are most familiar with, and most of us like most, are the sutras and the Vinayas. The sutras are the basic stuff of the teaching. The Vinayas have to do with the precepts, either monastic or lay, the monastic ones being six volumes in great detail. This is why it takes a specialist. Each monastery needs a specialist to get through that stuff. Then there's the Abhidhamma. Now, the Abhidhamma is composed of the commentaries and analyses on the first two sections. Many of these, I will freely admit, are mind-numbing. They are lists and charts and explanations, page after page after page of one phrase. It's very, very hard going. Frankly, a lot of it I don't get too much out of, but every once in a while, if you persist, you come up with these little gems. And here's a little gem for you. I think it's a little gem. This is from the Abhidharma text, a commentary by a monk named Buddhaghosa, who was a 5th century Indian, what do they call it? I don't know what the word would be. There's no exact English word. He was a scholar monk, but he was also a meditation master. I don't know exactly how you put all those together, but this is part of his commentary, and it's included in the work known as the Minor Readings, or the Kudakapatha, Volume 1, which is not, strictly speaking, an Abhidhamma work, but this is Buddhaghosa's commentary on the phrase Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami, as translated by Bhikkhu Nanamoli. The words are frequently translated into English as I undertake the training precept of abstinence from. Okay? Now that already adds a whole bunch of meaning. I undertake the training precept of abstinence. I undertake, okay, not it's coming down at me from somewhere. I voluntarily, presumably, undertake this. And it's a training precept. We're not quite sure what they mean by that, but it implies something more there of abstaining from whatever. Okay. So that's the usual mildly abbreviated form. The words, "I undertake the training precept of abstinence," Veramani Sika Padam Samadhi, are shared by all the precepts. And so the following explanation of these words as to phrasing and meaning can be commonly understood to apply to all. First, Varam, it crushes risk. Thus, it is abstention, Varamani. The meaning is that it abandons risk or harm. It eliminates it, it does away with it, it annihilates it. Or, alternatively, refers to a person with an instrument who abstains, Viramani, from risk. And risk here, Vera, abstain, Vira. Thus, substituting the syllable ve for the syllable vi, vi, it is abstention, Varamani. And hence it is pronounced in two ways, Varamani or Viramani. Next part. Sikataba, it should be trained in. Thus it is training, sika, and one proceeds with it, pajate. Thus it is a state, pada, and sika padam is the resolution of these compounds, meaning it is the means by which to arrive at training. Also, it is the root or pada, support or foundation of training. Oh, how neat. The abstention itself is a foundation, a training foundation, thus, sometimes translated, a training precept. Sama, I completely, adyami, undertake, thus I undertake. What is meant is that I take it upon myself with the intention to keep it, the intention of non-transgressing, the intention of keeping it untorn, unmuddled. You put it all together, and what have you got? You've got something that's sort of like, okay, I firmly resolve to undertake, to take upon myself, that foundation or way of and to training, which consists of refraining from doing the harm of whatever. Mm-hmm. Now that's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. And when you're reciting this somewhere, you can't go through all that. And it's got several variants even in it. Okay? But by golly, when you take it back to its ancient form, there's some very useful stuff in there, and it doesn't sound, you can't mistake that for a thou shalt. I firmly resolve to take upon myself the foundation of training, which is to refrain from doing the harm of whatever. So, it seems to me that the approach of trying to substitute something else for the precept is rife with possible pitfalls, and that the taking of the precepts themselves do not need to and do not have inherent in them the problems of judgmentalism, the problems of misuse, etc., the problems of infantilization, the problems of distracting one from the goal, in the real sense of goal, to goals in the unreal sense. Therefore, to me, it frankly is nonsensical to spend all this time meditating, all this time with mindfulness, all this time with all these other aspects of training, and then try to reinvent the wheel when it comes to sila, to the precepts, to action. Because, viewed in this way, these precepts are the distilled, in one way of looking at them, is they are the distilled essence of the training of all those many generations of Buddhists before us. And they learn things. And it would be just plain dumb not to pay attention. So, can the precepts be a focus for judgment or fear? Of course they can. Are they? Sure. I do that sometimes. I get scared sometimes. I sometimes criticize myself or others.
Sure.
They can be a focus for that, if you let them be. And if you don't catch yourself when you're doing that, and die as we stop it. That's not what this stuff is about.
Remember, Veramani Sika Padam Samadhi and me.
Oh, yeah, right. Now, in the readings that one does, in particularly in the Zen readings, you're apt to find a number of examples where people who keep the precepts are criticized indirectly, or sometimes quite directly, as being fearful or judgmental. In fact, the people who hold the position that I hold in the temple here of a precept specialist or Vinaya specialist are frequently the straight men in Zen stories. The Vinaya master comes along in some sort of a huff and sets up the situation for the Zen master to then come in and act in a very free and spontaneous way, which happens to be, in that first sense, of the Shurangama sense, of one with enlightenment and therefore with compassion and therefore with the true spirit of precept, and demonstrates that you don't have to hang on the way that nasty old Vinaya master was hanging on. So I get a chuckle out of these, because, you know, it's, okay, precept specialist as straight man. Let me give you an example. Here's one from Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. In Tokyo of the Meiji era, there lived two prominent teachers of opposite characteristics. One, Unsho, an instructor in Shingon, kept the Buddhist precepts scrupulously. He never drank intoxicants, nor did he eat after 11 o'clock in the morning. The other teacher, Tanzan, a professor at the Imperial University, never observed the precepts. These are both priests, by the way. When he felt like eating, he ate. When he felt like sleeping in the daytime, he slept. One day, Unsho visited Tanzan, who was drinking wine at the time, not even a drop of which is supposed to touch the tongue of the Buddhist. "Hello, brother," Tanzan greeted him. "Won't you have a drink?" "I never drink," exclaimed Unsho solemnly. One who does not drink is not even human," said Tanzan. "What do you mean to call me inhuman just because I do not indulge in intoxicating liquids?" exclaimed Unsho in anger. "Then if I am not human, what am I?"
"A Buddha," answered Tanzan.
Now that's a beautiful example of that. We have both judgment and fear in the same nice little package.
Okay,
and there are just scads of those peppered and salted throughout the literature of Zen. So one can get the impression that those who really keep scrupulously to the precepts, or keep wholeheartedly, let's say, to the precepts, can get into this judgment, fear kind of business, or anger kind of business. And of course they can. As we've said, judgment is the problem, fear is the problem, anger is the problem. But it's not the precepts that are the problem, and I have a very good reason, very good practical reason for saying that, is because I've met an example of a precepts master who isn't like that at all. And that is Reverend Seksian To, who is the late Bodhisattva precepts master of my master, Reverend Gio Kenneth. He's the one who gave her the Bodhisattva precepts, which are the ones you have in Buddhist writings, the 58 Bodhisattva precepts. He came from China to do that. I met him in Malaysia. It's been 10 years ago or so. And I don't think I have ever met a gentler soul than Reverend Sian To. He was very elderly by the time I met him, and in very poor health, and he sort of looked as if a gust of wind could blow him over. But there was a twinkle in that man's eye, and a smile, a genuine smile, and not a trace that I was able to discern of judgmentalism. He was exceedingly compassionate. he was so compassionate and loving that just to be around him was a pleasure. It just, he just glowed something. And if that, and he had good reason, if he had good reason in the worldly sense to be a bitter old man, he didn't get out of China in time. He was tortured. His temple was burned by the communist Chinese. They finally let him go. He finally made his way to Malaysia. But unlike many of the others who were there, he didn't get out in time. But he wasn't a bitter old man. He was the sweetest old man I've ever met. And by golly, if that is the result of a lifetime of being a precepts master, give me more. So it can't be devotion to the precepts itself that produces judgment or fear or anger. Now, but since judgment, fear, and anger and those things can attach themselves to precepts and to preceptual practice, what can we do so that that doesn't happen to us? Well, I would suggest that we go back to some of those things that were postulated as substitutes for the precepts, and instead of using them as substitutes, use them as complements. For instance, mindfulness, meditation, compassion, and non-attachment. Those are the things which break down judgmentalism, which undermine attachment and fear and anger. And so what I'm suggesting is that just as those things cannot be substituted productively for the precepts can't be substituted for them. You need both. And in that, you go right back to the beginning. The Buddha, at his enlightenment, saw and passed on a path. And it wasn't a one-fold path or a three-fold path. It was an eight-fold path. And I suspect it was an eight-fold path for a reason. I suspect he knew what he was doing. And I suspect that you need all eight. You need right mindfulness and right action. You need right meditation and right speech. You need right understanding or right wisdom or right samadhi. You also need right livelihood. It's one thing. The Eightfold Path is one thing. And when we try to pick apart that one thing, take something out and say, well, this will do it all. Now, in one sense, if you did that absolutely and completely, 100%ly, and it generalized out, you would be doing all the other seven as well, so it would do it all. But the wise trainee doesn't rely on that. The wise trainee sees that the Buddha set forth an eightfold path. And we make use of all eight. So that is the conclusion I came to in looking at the question of whether the precepts are obsolete. To me, they are not. And to me, it points right back to the very fundamental aspects of Buddhism, the most fundamental of all, the Eightfold Path. Okay, I have yammered sufficiently. I've yammered the whole time. It's an hour and a half. Oh, I was going to take questions. Oh, I don't think we have time. Sorry, friends. Another time. We'll do a question and answer.